in jeopardy in his early days. And so he is taken to Egypt, there to be protected and nourished until the time that his enemies are ready to be put aside, and so then he will be called back out of Egypt. And so what do we see then in the prophecy of Hosea? We see our Lord Jesus Christ in his identification with what it means on the part of his people to be unprotected and vulnerable and then protected for a time and then brought back into their place of ministry and being. So this is the prophecy of Hosea. You wouldn't understand that just reading it along, but Matthew tells us that the Lord put that signpost in there so that we would remember that our Lord Jesus Christ was touched with the feeling of our infirmities, that instead of, because remember that this young child, no longer a baby, but a young child, that he is still upholding the universe by the word of his power, instead of rising up to defend himself, what he does is he identifies with the weakness of his people, goes down to Egypt to be protected and nourished there until such time as he returns. And so that's the parallel. Now, just like every prophecy and its fulfillment, we don't want to get down into the weeds of it and go places it doesn't go. It's a very simple concept that we must receive from the evangelist Matthew here. And we'll see this in a moment as we move on with the other prophecy. Okay, so then in verse 16, Herod, when he saw that he was mocked of the wise men, because they'd been warned by God in a dream not to come back to him and to reveal where Christ was. Notice that the Lord is protecting his Messiah. It says that he was mocked of the wise men. What does that mean? Does that mean on the way out of town they went, nanny, nanny, nanny? No, it doesn't mean that. What it means actually is that they did not treat him as king. They didn't, on the way out of town, come and do obeisance to him as the monarch. So Herod saw that he was mocked. He sees the handwriting on the wall. My credit is going down. The credit of this other one is going up. So he doesn't know where Christ is, except that he's somewhere in Bethlehem. Of course, he's mistaken on that because Christ has already departed into Egypt. And so he does what any good tyrant would do. He uses what we call overkill. Right? Rather than find out, since he can't find out, he's going to make sure he gets them all. And so he gives an order from 2 years old and under that they should all be slain. All the babies, all the males. Now this is an interesting thing to think about, because now we have another prophecy that is brought forth from Jeremiah chapter 31 verse 15. Then was fulfilled that which was spoken by Jeremy the prophet, saying, in Ramah there was a voice heard, lamentation and weeping and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and would not be comforted because they are not. And again, if you turn back to Jeremiah chapter 31, you wouldn't recognize that. You wouldn't call that out as saying, hey, that's a messianic prophecy. I can see that here. No, we need Matthew's help with that. And again, what is the parallel? What is the prophetic and messianic element in it? Well, let's remember what Ramah was. We learn in chapter 40 and verse 1 of the prophecy of Jeremiah that Ramah was that final staging point when the captives are brought out of the sacked city, Jerusalem, by Nebuchadnezzar before they're shipped off to Babylon. That was the final point. And many of them died there because of the effects of the siege and so on. And so, looking at that, the prophet Jeremiah, back in chapter 31, says, in Ramah there was a voice heard, lamentation and weeping, and great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children, and would not be comforted because they are not. And we remember what place Rachel occupied in the affections of Jacob and the nation that day. They thought her to be Jacob's beloved wife, and all of the children of Israel in some sense related to her as Jacob's first and beloved wife. And so it looks as though that Nebuchadnezzar has brought the eternal felicity of the people of God to nothing in the slaying of the children of Israel. And so Matthew appropriates that very word at the behest of the Spirit of God. And why would he do that? Because it is as if Herod today, although he is king, has become a second Nebuchadnezzar to put the eternal and eschatological hopes of the people to death by slaying their Messiah. The eschatological hopes of the people of God had come to an end at Ramah. At least that's how it appeared. And that's how it might appear here to the casual observer. But when Herod was dead, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, "Arise, take the young child and his mother, and go into the land of Israel, for they are dead which sought the young child's life." So we learn quite a little bit, don't we, on how we interpret prophecies, especially messianic prophecies. We learn not to take our interpretations so very far and wide as to be confused by irrelevant details, but to take a look at the heart of those prophecies as they are appropriated by the New Testament authors, and to understand how the Lord has cared for His Christ. He has protected Him as He protected His ancient people. And while it may appear that the earthly and eschatological fortunes of the people of God have come to nothing, that is exactly not true, because it is the Lord that protects them. As a matter of fact, the Lord sent someone ahead, didn't He? He sent someone ahead. He sent men like Daniel to keep alive the messianic hopes of the people of God. And so much so, that those magoi came back with Daniel's message at the right time. Now there's one more passage here that is so very interesting, because it says here in verse 23, "He came and dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken," notice this, "by the prophets," plural, "that he should be called a Nazarene." Why the prophets, plural? Because in Hebrew, the word netzer, the word for shoot, is related to the Nazarene, to the place Nazareth, Nazareth. And so Matthew hears in the word Nazareth this concept of the shoot, this netzer of God, which is spoken of in Psalm 22, Isaiah 4:2, Isaiah 11:1, Jeremiah 23:5, Zechariah 3:8, and Zechariah 6:12. In other words, in the words of the prophets, he shall be called the Nazarene, or the netzer. I want to just show you one more thing, because this is fascinating. This is something I just learned this last week through a little bit of research. The Greek word in the Old Testament, in the Septuagint, for shoot, netzer, is Anatoly. We know perhaps men that are named Anatoly. It means the rising up, the shoot. Three times in the second chapter of Matthew, the word Anatoly is used. In the beginning, when the wise men say, "We have seen his star, Anatoly, in the rising." We have seen his star in the rising. And so where does Matthew end this second chapter? He ends it where he began, in the rising up of Christ, in the rising up of his star, and now here at the end, in the rising up, this shoot that would come up. And of course, when we hear about a shoot, we're going to understand the genius of this second chapter overall. Because what is a shoot? It's nothing. It's a sprig. It's a little thing that is easily tipped over, easily killed, easily comes to nothing. Doesn't it appear in this chapter that Christ is easy pickings? And yet, He continues to rise up. His star rises in the beginning. His credit rises on the part of the Magi as they come to Herod. Herod sees his credit rise so much that he wants to tip that little shoot over. Yet, he is the Netzer. He cannot be stopped. That's what Matthew is saying in chapter 2. He cannot be stopped. He will rise up. I know it took a little bit longer than it normally does, but I hope it was worth it. Let's stand and call upon the Lord in prayer.